With our special guest tonight, Joshua Warn. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about his Genesis experiment and also get into some other issues right here on Coast to Coast AM. Joshua, I may have a picture that someone just sent us of that Thunderbird from that old picture you were talking about. And if I can get it over to Lex, we'll see if he can post it on the coasttocoastam.com website. But what it shows is five people standing behind the body of this huge bird, which is spread out on the ground, not on a barn. And it looks like his neck is like curved in, and you could see his eyes and his beak. Now, I don't know if that's a real picture or not, but this bird is huge, absolutely huge. So we'll try to get this picture up on the coasttocoastam.com website.
Oh, if somebody has it, I mean, this would be an enormous development. I mean, this would go beyond any sort of discovery I've expected to find. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. And, you know, before the break, I was just mentioning that one thing about the Genesis experiment that is so valuable is the fact that very few scientists have the power that you have, for example, George, to reach millions of people in order to get them to participate with an experiment. And I think that that is a key factor in developing our research, because considering these things happen so rarely in general, if we can now get millions of people involved in looking for mysteries or participating in experiments, this could bring us to a whole new era of science. And I would say that right now, 99% of your listeners, wherever they are, home, car, whatever, if a ghost appeared beside them right now, well, what would they do to document it? You know, very few people are prepared to do something within 60 seconds to document an anomaly.
Even with a UFO sighting, same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a matter of, well, it always comes back to the fact people write me all the time and they say, well, I don't have the funding. I don't have the money. And everybody they cringe a little bit when you start talking about money. But the fact is there's nobody out there writing us checks to do paranormal investigation. And if everybody would participate, if everybody would find a way to generate money for themselves, to get the equipment, to go out and do this on their own, to keep a camera in the car, then it would be, I think, exponentially beneficial when it comes to documenting these things. And in fact, on your website, you have a link to howtohuntghosts.com, and that is a site that I formed in order to give people affordable equipment. You know, you can, like, for $49.95, you can buy a kit that gives you some of the basic equipment that you need. You can keep it in your car or whatever so that you can document these things when they occur. Paranormal groups or websites can become an affiliate and earn money for their group, because nobody else is going to give us the funding for this. So I hope that any listener who's interested in documenting this stuff will go to howtohuntghosts.com and find that there are ways that we can fund ourselves and fund our own research by getting affordable tools and by earning money.
We had a fascinating caller first hour who said, he's a small ghost investigator, and he said, if I could earn a living doing this, I'd do it full time. And he was dead serious and very excited about it. But you don't have to earn a living to enjoy doing this, do you?
No, not at all. And in fact, I mean, for me, it's more of a passion than anything. I mean, I tell people that first and foremost, my occupation is a writer. You know, I write books, I do speaking engagements, and I've been fortunate to be able to make a living for many years based upon the fact that I am one of those people who is providing information that others find valuable. But if this stuff is happening as rarely as I think it is, and, you know, I mentioned maybe once a year a manifestation happening, then if you only have a handful of us out there looking for this stuff, we're not going to make the same kind of headway as fast enough as if we have millions of people out there helping. And I would like to think that everybody out there would take the means necessary to document this stuff. You know, whether they do it through howtohuntghosts.com and the materials that we have, or going out on their own and finding whatever resources they need for what they want to research, we've come to the point now that we need that kind of mass participation in order to make up for the fact that these things happen so rarely.
Lex has the picture, and he's attempting to get it on the coasttocoastam.com website. So as soon as it's posted, I'll let everybody know, including you, Joshua. You can go take a look at it and then give us your real appraisal of what you think this photograph is.
Okay, well, I hope I can do that. Right now, I have my computer disconnected so that my phone line will be as clear as possible.
No, okay.
But I might have to take a little break and get back with you on that.
This is it is quite a picture, and then we'll get a lot of reaction from listeners as well. A couple of years ago, we talked about a moon anomaly footage picture. You mentioned it earlier tonight, too. Brief us on that, and then update us on it.
Okay. For about 15 years, I was mentored by a man named Charles Yost, who sadly passed away last year. He was a NASA Hall of Fame engineer. And he found a piece of footage that was actually slipped into one of the documentaries I think NOVA did at one point that shows something that appears to look like a smokestack on the moon. This was shot by the Apollo 8 mission as they flew over the surface of the moon. There is this black object sticking out, and right as the camera is about to pass over it, what looks like something along the lines of a puff of smoke comes out. And I don't know what this is, but he was fascinated by it, and so he allowed me to put it on my website. I talked about it some on Coast to Coast AM. After that, there was a firestorm of controversy back and forth on our discussion board about what this thing could be. And eventually, there were several people who said, well, this probably is not real footage at all. It's probably a still photograph of the moon surface that someone zoomed into with a camera to give the illusion of moving, and this must be a piece of dust or some debris that caused this illusion. To which I said, okay, maybe that's right. I don't know. I can't go to the moon. I can't say for myself. So I just left that footage up there on the website. And, of course, any of your listeners can go to lemurteam.com, L-E-M-U-R-team.com, to see this. And then about 2 months ago, I was contacted by an individual claiming to be a NASA affiliate who wanted to let me know that people at NASA believe that this is not an optical illusion, that the footage is legitimate. And my first reaction was, well, how do I know that you are really affiliated with NASA? So Lemur did everything possible to independently confirm this person's affiliation, and we do now believe this person is actually with NASA, and this person said that there are lots of people at NASA who would like the world to know that this is real, but that certain aspects of this footage are considered classified. And I must tell you, I hate to sound paranoid, but after I posted an update on the website saying that we had someone from NASA who feels this footage is legitimate, a lot of weird stuff started happening in my life that, well, I'll give you an example.
Okay, tell us.
Okay, I've had a P.O. box for about 11 years now. And the day that I posted this information on the Internet, my assistant went to the P.O. box. And it was locked. So she called me and said, well, did you pay this thing up?
I said, yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, sometimes you get that notice, and if you forget to pay it, they lock it until you pay them, right?
Exactly. And so she went inside and asked them, and they said, I mean, this is the day I posted this stuff.
Okay.
And they told her, well, we need Mr. Warren to come in here because due to some Homeland Security situation, we need for him to reconfirm all of his information regarding where he lives and so on and so forth. So I called a friend of mine whose father has worked for the Postal Service for about 30 years and said, is this normal? And his father said he didn't know anything about this being normal. So I went in and I showed them my driver's license. I showed them my Social Security card. And they said, oh, well, do you have a voter registration card? Yes. So I showed them that. And they opened it back up. Well, a few days later, this young bald guy pops up at my house. And he looked very, very tight and trim and kind of militaristic, you could say. He was driving a car.
Was he in a suit?
He wasn't in a suit. He was wearing like a polo shirt and blue jeans.
Okay.
And started knocking on my door. He had government tags on his car, saying that he was looking for an address that was much farther down the road than mine. And I told him that, well, you've got the wrong house. And as it turns out, before he'd come to my house, he went to my neighbor's house first, and my neighbor's house is way back up in the woods. My house is much closer to the road, and it seems funny to me that this person would have gone to the neighbor's house first before coming to mine if he was actually looking for something
down the other
side. Address. And so it's, and you know, I could talk on and on about these kinds of things, and I don't know if it's coincidence, but I tell you, right when I posted this stuff, I started getting a lot of things like that happening that make me wonder if there is something to this footage, because the NASA informant said that Lemur and I are being investigated because they want to see exactly how much that we know. So, you know, take that for what you will, but I learned in January that the Russians announced that they are going to the moon. They're going to have a base up there by 2015, and by the year 2020, they're going to be planning on mining a substance called helium-3, which is a fuel source for fusion that could power Earth for thousands of years if they learn how to appropriately deal with this substance. And all this speculation about this smokestack-like anomaly possibly being related to mining or some operation is quite ironic when you consider that now, right when all this stuff is sort of coming to a head with me, the Russians say they're going there to mine this valuable resource. So, you know, I don't know what this is all about, but I think that this footage we have is worthy of serious consideration, and it might indeed be a piece of evidence for the fact that somebody is up there already mining these resources on the moon.
Who do you think that might be?
Well, if this footage that I have really did come from the Apollo 8 mission, and I have no doubt of that, which was done in the 60s, I don't feel that humans, based upon our traditional timeline of knowledge, had the ability to be up there mining this stuff at that point in time. So if humans didn't do it, well, I'm open to the possibility that some other intelligence is up there mining it.
Well, you know, Joshua, there have been others who have remote viewed the moon, and they have seen alien structures and artifacts on the moon. So this would not be unusual if there's indeed some kind of structure there.
Well, the moon itself is so unusual in many ways that most people don't even realize. I mean, for one thing, it seems that significant portions of the moon are hollowed out. I mean, the moon rings like a bell when it's struck. In fact, in 1969, Apollo 12 sent part of their lunar module crashing back, and the moon rang for hours. And then on March 13th of 1972, a meteorite struck the moon, and the scientists at NASA were waiting to hear where the core of the moon could be by seeing how long it took the wave from the impact to hit the core and bounce back, but no seismic wave returned from the core. And in fact, NASA's Dr. Gordon McDonnell said that there was substantial evidence for a hollowed-out moon as far back as 1962. And this, of course, lends some credence to the possibility that sections are being or have been mined. Additionally, on March 7th of 1971, Apollo instruments left on the moon indicated some mysterious, quote-unquote, wind of water vapor that was spraying across the surface. And I think this lasted about 14 hours and covered like 100,000 yards or miles, something like that. I forget exactly what the measurement was. And they've also found rocks on the moon that have rust, which requires oxygen and free hydrogen molecules, and that might also indicate that there's liquid water on the moon. And so it makes me wonder if when we see some sort of puff come out of this smokestack-like anomaly, if we're looking possibly at water vapor, which is associated with this mining operation, hence the evidence we have for significant portions of the moon being hollow.
Well, there's a lot of, I don't know about the hollow part of it, Joshua, but there's a lot of stuff going on there, and somebody's going to go back and find out, and I wish it were us.
Well, right now, LEMUR has established an observatory because chances are we'll never get to go to the moon ourselves, but at least we can look at it in detail, and we're trying to see if some of these anomalies, which some have said are hundreds or thousands of feet tall, might be detectable using telescopes. But I do think that there's good reason to believe, if for no other fact, that we have so much helium-3 up there, that some intelligence is making use of that. And, you know, the whole point of going to the moon was originally to sort of compete with other countries such as the Russians. We now know the United States has claimed that we're going back to the moon. And it just makes me wonder exactly what is happening up there, what has been happening, and what value that it could have for our energy resources. And we know that, you know, the people who control the energy control the world.
Absolutely. Hey, tell me about Discovery's X-Ops team.
Well, X-Ops is actually produced by a man named Jim Castle, who has won multiple Emmys, and I know you are an Emmy winner, so you know that's a mark of true quality, George. And he won one of his Emmys for the X-Files TV program. And so this show, X-Ops, is kind of like the real-life X-Files. Because even though it's a logical idea to take a bunch of experts in different arenas and send them out to investigate mysteries, it really hasn't been done all out with a lot of funding and resources until just now, thanks to the Discovery Channel. And so we have a team of eight of us, and it includes scientists like myself. We have psychics. We have a Native American shaman. We've got people like Jim Mars, Nick Redfern, Brian Irish. These are people who have vast experience, and we have a base camp in California at the Norton Air Force Base. We actually have our own hangar there, and it's kind of
fun. Do you? That's exciting.
Well, you know, some people say that UFOs have been hidden there in the past, which adds another dimension to the fascination. But, you know, we got out there to shoot this thing, and we were blown away because we had our own private jet. We had a helicopter to shoot aerial photos. We had all the color thermal cameras, all the equipment that you would need. And the plan is that we're going to travel the world taking the most thorough look ever at the greatest mysteries, trying to get to the bottom of them once and for all. We figured we'd start right here in the United States, and so we went to Roswell. In the beginning, everybody said, oh, great, you know, Roswell, same old stuff. Yes, we know, there was a crash there, you know, they found alien bodies. But the new twist, of course, is that there are many people who are seeing now the apparitions of the dead aliens, especially around the area at the hospital there that occupies the very same property where the Roswell Army Airfield Hospital used to be. And, you know, after long enough in interviewing people and sizing them up, you can kind of tell if people are being honest with you. And these folks who are seeing these alien apparitions are some of the most down-to-earth, honest people I've ever met. And so we went out there and we spent a week. We went to the crash site. We went to Hangar 84, which is where the bodies were brought first. And we even did a seance at Hangar 84.
Was it strange to be out there near the crash site?
Oh, good grief. I mean, just standing there, reaching down, scooping up a handful of dirt at the place where a craft from another world may have landed. And you know what? The whole time we were there, there were white Suburbans in the distance watching us.
Uh-huh. With telephoto lenses, no doubt, Joshua. Stay with us. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've got two photos posted of what could be Thunderbirds on the coasttocoastam.com website. You might have to hit your refresh button. Joshua, if you can go take a look at it as well. Two different photos, two different birds. I don't know if they're real or not, but the second one, the Arizona Thunderbird, to me is a little more convincing than the one that just has the photo link to it. They both look like pterodactyls, but take a look at it and fast blast me, tell me what you think. But I do think the Arizona Thunderbird of the two might be the one that looks authentic. We'll get Joshua's reaction if we can. He's got to fidget around with his computer when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Joshua Warren. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines and take your calls as well. Joshua, did you have the opportunity to get up to the website and look at those two bird pictures?
You know, I haven't, but at the next break, if your producer will come on the line and give me an opportunity to disconnect my phone, hook my computer back up, and then call me back, then I will be able to do it. So
you're not asking for too much here, Joshua.
Only I would put Coast to Coast AM off the line for a bit. So.
All right, we'll have Tom do that right at the top of the hour.
Good, good.
And that'll give you a chance. Look at the two pictures on the coasttocoastam.com website. One, there's a link that you can get just pop. It says photo. The other one says Arizona Thunderbird. I think the second one, the Arizona Thunderbird of the two, looks the most authentic, but I want your take on it.
Okay, well, I would love to see it. I mean, I'm kind of chomping at the bit because if this is it, we have a big night right here. This is an historic occasion.
I tell you, they're both fantastic pictures. I love them both.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see them. And, you know, when it comes to what we were talking about before with X-Ops, the difficult part about this whole arena of research is actually capturing something legitimate on film, on camera. And, you know, I mentioned earlier when I was at the Queen Mary, for example, that I didn't really expect to see much because when you're doing a TV show, it's very rushed and there are many objectives to keep in mind. So when we were doing X-Ops out there in Roswell, I didn't really expect to see anything. I mean, I figured that it would be a great experience, but I had no real belief in the fact that we were going to get something tangible there that we could pass along that was going to, you know, change people's perception of ghosts or aliens. And I've got to be honest with you, I've been a guest on this show many times now. I've been doing research for a long time, and I don't think I've ever built up anything too much and ever delivered.
No, you lay it right out there.
Well, thank you.
That's what I like about you.
And, you know, when we did that seance at Hangar 84, something manifested, and they captured it beautifully on camera. And it's the kind of thing, and I want to be careful what I say because I don't want to get in trouble with Discovery because they don't want me to spoil anything.
Obviously, it's not been aired yet, right?
That's right. It hasn't been aired yet. But I'm telling you, something appeared, and when you see it, it will send a shudder down your spine. Everybody should see this. And we should have the air date for it. I mean, any day now. It's probably going to air this month. But I'd like to tell your listeners, anybody who wants to know when this thing is going to air, just go to either the Genesis Experiment webpage or many of my other ones linked up through coasttocoastam.com. You'll find a place where you can put your email address in our data bank, and this is spam-free. We will not give your address out to anybody. You will get no spam whatsoever, and when I get the air date, I will personally write a message to your listeners and let them know when this thing is going to air.
You may be writing for the next year.
Well, probably. I mean, once people see this, I've never seen anything like it. I really haven't.
Now, did you see the anomaly while you were there, or did you see it later, maybe on video or however you might have captured it?
It was over our heads. So none of us were looking above our heads. We were all looking at each other conducting the seance, and then this thing manifested over our heads. One of the crew members dropped to the floor. I mean, this is just a cameraman who was there shooting this. He dropped to the floor when this happened and started getting nauseated and cramps. I mean, we still don't know exactly what happened to this guy. And so later, when we watched the footage, only then did we see this appear over our heads.
You mean instead of manning his camera, he falls to the floor?
Yeah, he fell completely to the floor. I mean, it was almost a call 911 situation. I mean, it took everybody a while to realize what was happening here, because everybody was wrapped up on the seance in terms of focusing at that point. And then when this guy went down, it took everybody a second to realize what was happening. And then we watched this footage later, and I mean, it coincides with this manifestation. And I think that's a good example of how some people are more sensitive to whatever change occurs in the environment when these things materialize.
It makes you really wonder, Joshua, what happened at Roswell in 1947, doesn't it?
Well, you know, before I got involved with this project, the concept of UFOs and aliens always seemed a little bit disconnected from me, frankly, because it seemed like something way out there that I could never really get a grasp on directly. And then when I went to Roswell, especially as I was mentioning, when I was standing there, you know, feeling the sand where this thing crashed, it personalized it for me. And if you start looking at just the chain of events alone in terms of the Roswell situation, I mean, the most secret project that the United States has ever worked on that we have admitted publicly is the Manhattan Project. And where do they choose to develop this? In New Mexico at Los Alamos.
Yep, exactly.
Then in 1945, we had the first nuclear detonation. Almost exactly 2 years later, something crashed out there in that desert, not far from the base where we had the best aviators in the world, the people who dropped the atomic bombs, where the Enola Gay was stored. And then we have, of course, this press release coming out, which states, I think, four times that there was a flying disc, and they didn't make any bones about it. They didn't say, we might have a disc, we're not sure. They said, we have a disc here. And then, of course, the general comes out and says, no, it was just a weather balloon, which is an insult to the intelligence of these fine aviators who saw it, who were used to dealing with secret matters. And then we have, only days later, I think it was about 18 days later, Truman signed the National Security Act, creating the Air Force, the CIA, the National Security Council, giving unprecedented power to the government to keep things secret regarding aircraft. And even today, the government admits there was a cover-up of some kind. I mean, they say, well, we were looking at, you know, Russian technology through Project Mogul. And you have all these people who, just before they died, came out and said, no, let me tell you, this was real. We had alien bodies there. And you have people like Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, you know, a year before he died, he published this book saying that lasers, fiber optics, microchips, night vision, Kevlar, all this stuff is the product of back engineering technology. And so at very least, when you look at the timing of these events connected to the Roswell incident and you place it into historical context, that alone is compelling to say the least.
Well, you know, I know Bill Burns very well. He's co-writing my very first book with me called Worker in the Light. And he's the one who wrote The Day After Roswell with Philip Corso. Mm-hmm. And I had a chance to talk with him not on, and he's been on my program before, Bill Burns has, but I had a chance to talk with Bill about Roswell years ago, face to face. And I said, Bill, you and I are friends. We've known each other for years. I need to know this. He looks me in the eyes, Joshua, straight conviction. And, you know, you can tell when someone's pulling your leg or not. He looks me in the eyes and says, Philip Corso told me exactly what he believes he knew and he saw, and we put it in this book the day after Roswell. And when you hear it from someone that you know, that you trust, all of a sudden your entire perception changes. I am convinced that Philip Corso, before he died, wrote his story, wanted to tell the world about it because he knew he had to get it out. Bill still has copies of Corso's notes, and it's amazing stuff there. And there's no doubt in my mind that something happened at Roswell that was out of this world. No doubt.
No, well, I agree entirely. And, I mean, the very fact that when we were there, we had white Suburbans in the distance observing us shows that there was something there, whether or not it was related to aliens, that some organization did apparently not want us to find or was at least interested in what we did find.
How long did they stay there?
The whole time, the entire time. I mean, we took four-wheel drive vehicles way out into the desert, and I know there are at least two or three different sites that people claim are crash sites, and apparently when this thing exploded in the air or whatever, it was sort of like an airplane crash. You don't have necessarily one particular spot that is the crash site. It's spread out over an area. But after talking to the locals and getting the most dependable information, this was the spot where we were told we'd have the highest chances of finding some evidence. And, I mean, we went off-roading deep into the desert, and then the whole time and it took a while to realize that one of the cameramen was, you know, zooming in and said, hey, what, is that a vehicle sitting on that hill over there? And sure enough, this white Suburban is there, and I can't say who it was.
Could you see people in it? Did they have binoculars? Could you make that out?
It was too far away to see the individuals inside. But it reminds me very much of what I've seen represented much more clearly from Area 51 investigations. It's the same kind of thing. And I don't think that whatever agency is involved here, and whatever their affiliation to the government may be, I don't think that they would show themselves if they didn't want to be seen. I almost saw it as an intimidating measure. It's like, we don't have to be sitting here, but we want you to know you're being observed.
Well, but you've just brought up something very interesting. We really don't know who they were. You know, if one believes that there's this higher government, the, as Morgus calls it, Dr. Morgus, the higher order, the Illuminati, I call it, who knows who they might have been, Joshua? Who knows where they came from? They may have just heard that you guys were going to be out there at Roswell, and they decided, you know what? We just, and you're right, we want them to know that we're watching them. But you'll never know who they were.
Well, I think that certainly the government has perfected on paper, if nothing else, the setup where the governmental agencies themselves are not directly responsible and accountable for these types of developments, projects, research. What they do is they contract private companies and private organizations to work with them. And that way, they get all the rights to privacy that any ordinary citizen has. And you can't march into a government office and say, I demand for you to tell me what information you have, because they don't technically have anything. It's the private organizations they contract that have them. And those private organizations demand a lot of money. And what it boils down to me, is it's the rich people, you know? It's the people who have the money. And we go back and forth. We debate all the time over Republicans and Democrats. There are only two parties in this world, the rich and the poor. And that's because that everything we do is reduced down to the dollar. And therefore, I feel that, for example, if you want to run for president, you have to have millions and millions of dollars to even be a serious contender. And where does that money come from? And then what alliances do you have to form to get that money? And so I do feel that whatever these UFOs are here for, whatever position they have in our society, that they are of enormous value on a financial level somewhere along the line. And therefore, you have a handful of very wealthy individuals in this world who ultimately pull the strings. And the facade of politics and all these are here to give us, you know, the more simplistic measures that we need to keep order and form society and civilization. But any organization has a group of people at the center who are not necessarily officially labeled or have something written on paper. It's just, you know, the elite group within, and those are the people who are pulling the strings.
You know, I've known you, Joshua, for a couple of years now. I have never heard you nervous. I've never heard you scared of an investigation. You've gone into a lot of them that most people could be scared. Tonight's the first night that I have picked up from you when you talk about these vans and you talk about that visitation at your house. This is the first time I have felt you to be a little uneasy. Am I pretty accurate in feeling this off of you?
Yes, you are. Absolutely. And I think it's taken years of me being involved with this kind of research and expanding it beyond ghosts. Because, you know, when I first started out looking at ghosts, I was looking at one little facet, one little aspect of this phenomena or of these phenomena. And as time has gone on, it's sort of expanded and grown and evolved into different areas, as you can see. And I think that a lot of people say, oh, you know, he's looking for ghosts. You know, he can tell some good stories about a campfire. But when these areas start reaching into government facilities and things that might be associated with the rich, and you start having weirdos pop up at your house, and you start being told that Homeland Security needs you to revalidate your information and so on, you know, if they, and when I say they, if a government agency will conspire over what happened between, say, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, imagine what they will do over the important stuff. And you and I both know time and time again how many of these scientists who have been right there on the verge of breaking some news about new energy, for example, have mysteriously died. And in fact, there was a scientist right here in my hometown of Asheville, North Carolina, named Dr. Rick Moss, who was involved with the project to bring some valuable new energy to the forefront, a Hydrino project he was working on. And I was in contact with him, and then I just found out that 54 years old, the guy died. And they said he had a blood disorder. And you got people like Dr. Eugene Maloff, who were right on the brink of unveiling something, and they yep. die mysteriously. And I'm not saying that we necessarily have an organization running around there, you know, killing people. What I'm saying is that there is some force in the universe that seems to be working against us in terms of developing these new technologies.
Well, we know that the scientists are dying. We know that most of them are relatively young. We know that they're working on some major things. All of those are coincidental. And as you know, I say there are no coincidences. Therefore, the synchronicity of the relationships between all of them, their deaths, their age, is very, very strange.
Yeah, well, I agree entirely. There is no such thing as a coincidence, because that would imply there could be an effect without a cause. And that does not make sense. And I don't know if there is some greater power that is, you know, manipulating the timelines, just like I was mentioning with something like the Thunderbird photograph in Tombstone, Arizona, that is you know, taking...
Which you'll see in just a moment, by the way.
Yes, that's right. I'm looking forward to that. Or if it's something more sinister and closer to home. But either way, we cannot deny the realistic aspect here that people are dying right before they were about to unveil something that will solve this energy crisis. And from there on, we can only speculate as to what's in play here.
Well, I've got to tell you, of everything you've investigated now over the last couple of years, is there one facet that just... really still thrills you more than the other?
Well, right now, Our team is on the verge of creating what may be the closest device ever to communicating with the dead.
This is like a Thomas Edison machine, huh?
That's right. And the basis is that when people go out and they take these EVPs with their recorders, usually they don't have any kind of an antenna they're using. The closest thing would be an external microphone or whatever microphone they're using. I have been doing, and we have been doing, enough research regarding what the physical conditions are when people have these experiences communicating with the other side, that my team and I are now constructing an antenna that is specifically designed to be able to pick up signals from the vacuum.
And how tall is the antenna? Would it fit in a studio?
Yes, it would.
I tell you what, Joshua, let's talk about this when we come back, because I also want to invite you then to come to Los Angeles when this machine is finished and test it on the air with us. We'll be back in a moment. Tommy's going to come get you. He'll free you up. You can go to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the two Thunderbird pictures, and give me your reaction. I'm George Norrie. Phone calls next. Your calls with our guest, Joshua Warren, on Coast to Coast AM.